Good evening, welcome to Behind the News for February 22nd, 2007. I think this is the date that used to be known as, formerly known as Washington's birthday, isn't it? And we're looking, as we do in most pieces, at this time of the world of economics and politics. We've got two segments up for tonight. First, in a little while, Amy Liu, who is the author of the book Gaining, The Truth About Life After Eating Disorders, just published by Warner Books. Certainly a little bit off the beaten track for this show, but this is a complex issue that doesn't always get talked about in its full complexity. And this book does just that, a very nice mixture of the personal and the analytical. We'll be speaking with Amy Liu when she gets here. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Sam Gindin, who is an economist based in Toronto, longtime advisor to the president of the Canadian Auto Workers Union, Buzz Hargrove. He's retired and now teaching at York University up in Toronto. And he had a piece on the Monthly Review zine website a couple of weeks ago called Is the Big Ship America Sinking? Contradictions and Openings. And Sam Gindin is a skeptic on all those narratives of economic and imperial decline that you hear about the United States. He thinks that the U.S. Is still a pretty strong economy and a pretty strong empire. Kind of unpopular view, certainly on the political left, but it's elsewhere in the political spectrum as well. Certainly, Orthodox people are full of pride about the state of American power and American prosperity. But a lot of people are not. And Sam Gindin, a bracing antidote to all those folks who are skeptical about the enduring strength of U.S. economic and political power. And some words about the economic news before we get to the rest of the show. The big economic news of the week so far was yesterday's report that consumer price inflation for January came in above the financial market's expectations. And before I proceed, maybe a word about expectations and reality would be in order. Civilians don't always understand the fact that markets, financial markets that is, typically react not to an actual piece of news so much as to an actual piece of news, but much more to how that piece of news compares to what their expectations were. So if the market was expecting a company's profits to be down 10% and they're down just 5%, that's good news. If they're expecting profits to be up 25% and they're up a mere 22%, that's bad news. Okay, back to inflation. Markets had gotten used to subdued numbers on price increases. They want things to stay that way, because if they do, the Fed won't raise interest rates anymore and might even start cutting them soon. As I pointed out last week, there are some contradictions in this position. The reason they think inflation may stay tame is because, or become even tamer, is because the U.S. economy has slowed down and gives signs of being on the verge of slowing down even more. Usually, a slower economy means less pressure on resources, physical and human. By human, I mean there will be less demand for workers and the unemployment rate will drift higher, which together mean less pressure for wage increases. But if the Fed starts cutting interest rates, that would stimulate the economy, and the whole tight economy, rising prices problem would be back again with a vengeance. But thinking that far is beyond Wall Street's normal range of vision. So the expectation was that consumer inflation, excluding food and energy, that's Wall Street's favorite measure because energy prices have been high and food prices have been rising too, and rising for much of the last couple of years, when you fervently want the Federal Reserve to ease, you can strip out the unpleasant stuff, like the rising prices, and look only at the more pleasing stuff, which is more stable prices. Now this measure, the so-called core inflation, that is, without stripping away the effects of food and energy prices, they expected this was going to rise 0.2% in January. Alarmingly, they were up 0.3%, or 0.256% before rounding. You might not think a tenth of a point, or more exactly 56 one-hundredths of a point, matters that much, but it does. So the stock and bond markets took a hit yesterday, and the hit continued into today. And today's hit was reinforced by the rise in oil prices to over $60 a barrel, the highest in some time, and news from Toll Brothers, the home builder, that their profits were off 67% in the latest quarter. This is the Toll Brothers is yet another casualty of the housing slowdown. We've seen quite a few of these in recent weeks. Home builders reporting lower than expected profits, but also mortgage lenders as well taking hits, and a couple actually going so far as to go under. Toll, the home builder, by the way, not only builds suburban McMansions, but is also perpetrating some of the horrific high-rises in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. A pox on them anyway. Back to inflation. Adding to the anxiety was the release of the minutes for the Federal Reserve's late January policymaking meeting, which showed lingering worry about inflation, surprisingly so, given their more sanguine public posture in recent weeks. They sounded confident that the housing market was stabilizing, that the broad economy was holding up despite housing's woes, and the job market was remaining strong. Now, some of these things are kind of questionable. Economic growth for the fourth quarter is likely to be revised downward. Early signs for the first quarter this year have been a little disappointing. We saw kind of disappointing numbers on first-time claims for unemployment insurance this morning. So some signs that the job market is softening. But the Federal Reserve thinks that things are not so bad, that the economy is actually in pretty good shape and will continue to grow at a decent pace throughout the rest of the year. So they feel that there's no urgent need to cut rates by any means, and some reason to be concerned about continuing inflationary pressures. Wall Street, which has a somewhat more downbeat view of the state of the economy, thinks that the Fed shouldn't be so anxious. But curiously, Wall Street, which is capable of believing at least two contradictory things at once, thinks that despite a slowing economy, corporate profits won't take a hit, and so the stock market should remain happy. Wall Street is inhabited by incurable optimists sometimes, it seems. According to the minutes of the Federal Reserve meeting, many participants observed that labor markets remained relatively taut, with significant wage pressures being reported in some occupations. In addition to the continuing shortages of skilled workers in technical and professional fields, recent reports suggested a scarcity of less skilled and unskilled workers in some areas of the country. One participant observed that some of the sluggishness in manufacturing job growth, which is an understatement, manufacturing job growth has been terrible for like the last 6 years, but they said that this could be due to difficulties in hiring rather than indicating weakness in demand. So far, aggregate measures of labor compensation were showing only moderate increases, but looking ahead, the possibility that labor costs might rise more rapidly as a result of the tightness of the labor market was seen as an upside risk to inflation. Now, that's the Federal Reserve, not me talking. End paragraph, beginning of the next. All meeting participants expressed some concern about the outlook for inflation. This is not what Wall Street wanted to hear. Now, it must be said that historically, the Fed has a better record in reading the economy's course than does the private sector, which is certainly an inversion of your usual conventional wisdom that the private sector is smart and the public sector is dumb. But the Fed has some pretty smart people working there, and their judgments aren't clouded by their materialist interests, as is often the case with Wall Street. But observe the class angle clearly. After an expansion, which has not been so good for workers, weak job growth and weak wage growth, a sharp contrast with stunning growth in upper bracket incomes and corporate profits, the Fed is determined that workers get not more than a few crumbs. So let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Amy Liu. And then an excerpt from the Piano Sonata No. 15 by Franz Schubert, performed by Andras Schiff. And now we're joined in the studio by Amy Liu, who is a prolific author of books of nonfiction and three novels, right? And her latest book is called Gaining, The Truth About Life After Eating Disorders, just out from Warner Books. And welcome to Behind the News, Amy.
Thanks, Doug. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start with the personal history. You were the author of one of the early books about eating disorders in
the 1970s. The first memoir of anorexia.
So certainly that was not the beginning of anorexia as a disease.
No,
but
no.
Tell us about your own personal history a little bit.
Well, actually, you and I met in Yale, or we were in Yale at the same time, when I was ending my anorexic career, so to speak. But I had been anorexic for about 7 years, all the way through my adolescence, and I came out of the eating phase of it without any treatment, and then about...
Or the not eating phase.
Well, yes, or the not eating, the food-obsessed phase and the weight-obsessed phase, and resumed my life thinking that everything was fine and I was done with it and I didn't have to deal with it.
And there wasn't really... much talk about the
there was
the
no talk
then.
About it.
So
no one knew
how
to treat it.
And you didn't know what even to call it. Right?
No, and it wasn't diagnosed. Nobody diagnosed. When we were in college, of course, there were many, many, many people with walking eating disorders, and virtually none of them were diagnosed or treated.
Yeah,
and
I don't
now
remember hearing
middle-aged.
The word into the 80s when I used to know some dancers, and of course, it's rampant in that profession.
That's right.
And so that's where I became familiar with all the eating disorders, but it must have been strange to be going through this and not really know what it was.
Nobody did. And to my astonishment, still a great many people don't know what it is. They're not getting proper treatment. The insurance companies are playing this game with people where they deny that there's any biochemical basis to it. Everybody acts as if it's a choice that these young women and men starve themselves or exercise compulsively, and they don't recognize that there's a biochemical basis for it. It's a medically based mental illness, just like schizophrenia, just like bipolar disorder, alcoholism. In point of fact, anorexia has the highest mortality rate of any mental illness, and yet it's basically cast aside as if it doesn't quite matter.
And you're right that there have been some recent discoveries of genetic aspects, right?
Yeah. The studies vary, but they show that anywhere from 56 to 83% of the risk for eating disorders is genetic. So it's absolutely biochemical and deserves to be treated like basically like diabetes. But
and there are a lot of explanations which are sort of pop, but not entirely, that anorexia is a protest against affluence. It's the fault of the fashion industry. It's a resistance to the bodily changes that come with puberty.
Mm-hmm.
About, 85 or 90% of anorexics are female?
Actually, 75%.
Oh.
25% are male, and of those males, about one-fifth are gay, but the vast majority of the men who have eating disorders are straight men, which is another, you know, contradicts another widespread myth.
So those pop myths, are they worth anything?
They are. I think, and this is where it gets political, I think there's a tendency, especially in this country, to always want to blame one thing. And in virtually no walk of life that I know of is one thing ever the sole fault. And that's especially so in eating disorders, where you have genetics interplaying with family, interplaying with culture. Scientists describe it like a gun. Genetics form the gun, environment arms the gun, and experience pulls the trigger. So,
and then you had a relapse in your 40s.
I did. That's what prompted me to write this new book, Gaining. I was undergoing a really tough time in my marriage. I'd separated from my husband, and all of a sudden I found myself not eating and fixating on my weight again, as if that was going to solve everything, or that was going to make me feel better for despite all the other losses that were going on. And fortunately, instead of falling back into the trap, I thought, whoa, this is very strange to be doing this again 30 years after I thought I was completely done with it. And so instead of letting it consume me, why don't I study it? And that was how I started the work that ended up leading to this book.
Because interesting choice of words, consume me.
It's an intentional, because that's actually what it is. It's eating disorders consume the identity and the body of the person who has it. So that basically that's why in this strange world that we live in, there are now pro-anorexia and pro-bulimia sites where people who are sick defend their disorder. And it's because they're so terrified of having to create an identity or take responsibility for other aspects of themselves beyond this that they cling to the disorder as their identity.
But what goes on your head? I mean, do you look in the mirror and see yourself as being grossly fat even though you're not? Yeah. Do you look at food and feel disgust? What is the internal experience of it like?
The internal experience is everything that you just described. It's very obsessive. And what the scientists now know is that eating disorders are very closely linked with depression, obsessive-compulsive disorder, anxiety disorders, and sometimes alcoholism gets in there. They're all kind of moving around in the same part of the brain, kind of cross-fertilizing each other. So there's a very high rate of obsessive-compulsive disorder in people, especially with anorexia and bulimia.
And which is all about issues of control and autonomy?
I think that's another one of those myths. It's the mindset is just obsessional. You can't it's like you program a computer and it can't stop thinking about what it's supposed to be thinking. It may start innocuously with a diet, but because the temperament that goes into making the disorder is highly perfectionistic, highly rule-bound, highly sensitive to criticism, and these are genetically determined traits, what you get is somebody who then says, I'm on a diet, I have to be on a diet, I have to stay on the diet, I'm okay as long as I'm losing a pound every other day, and that tends to then swallow up their whole life, and it becomes an obsession. And it's just like it's like an etching or a lithograph where the acid cuts a line in the plate, and it keeps cutting deeper and deeper and deeper the longer it lasts. Until after a few years of this, it's very, very difficult to retrain the brain to get out of it.
Now, the things you mentioned, that kind of obsessionality, for example, it could take many forms. Mm-hmm. What is it about food and thinness that makes that's the unique aspect to anorexia?
There tends to be among people with this temperament a tendency to cling to an overvalued ideal. One thing. So in our culture for women, that overvalued ideal is thinness. You get it from the culture. You get it from the fashion industry that tells women that they have to be as thin as a prepubescent 12-year-old girl. And then some women, some people have this tendency to cling to one idea above all others, especially when they're anxious. So you have a kind of a perfect storm right now in our culture where you have a fear-based culture and we're getting that fear thrown at us from everybody from the president to economists to, you know, dietitians and nutritionists.
Now climate scientists are adding to the
climate
the
scientists. And then you've got all the pressure in schools coming from families, the fear that if you don't go to college, if you don't get an advanced degree, you're going to fail, you're going to fail, you're going to fail.
There's a story in the Times today about the competition for sixth grade.
Yeah. Well, and even preschool, where yes. I live in Los Angeles. And,
yeah, well,
you know,
it's wacky island.
It's insane. So, but there's this idea that with all of those fears, if you get to be thin and you're female, you're okay. You're going to be okay. And you're going to be, in fact, you have a chance at being perfect if you just get thin enough. And because of the way their brains are put together, these young women seize on this one idea and it becomes a kind of a refuge from all the other anxiety. The great tragedy when this happens, and it happens not just for young women, it happens for for women, especially middle-aged women, and a lot of people just at all ages, they fixate on this idea of thinness, and it basically removes them from the rest of life. It removes them from becoming politically active. It removes them from becoming socially active. There's a phrase that I use. It's the half-life of eating disorders is what lingers if you don't get treatment and you don't deal with the underlying causes and you don't really understand what caused the eating disorder. You may start eating well, but you will only be living half your life because your life will still be ruled by this kind of obsessional thinking and fixating on trying to be perfect, needing to escape criticism.
So when you get down to 80 pounds, do you feel attractive and sexy, or do you aspire to invisibility?
No, you aspire to invisibility, and at that stage, there's kind of a turning point, you know, depending on how tall you are. I was 5'6". I got down to 90 pounds. I basically spent 7 years between 90 and 100 pounds. That's sort of the borderline. If I had gotten any below that weight, then the obsessionality would have dug in so deep that and I was really at that point. I sensed that I was going to go in that direction if I kept it up. So I actually remember the moment when I made the choice that I had to stop this. It took a long time getting back to anything even approaching normal, but I did make that choice, which is critical. Had I continued, then the obsessionality would have become a cycle that propelled itself, and it wouldn't have anything to do really with how I looked. It would just be, I have to not eat. I can't eat. I have to get thinner. I must see the numbers on the scale dropping, and this is how people die.
I'm speaking with Amy Liu, who is the author of the book Gaining, The Truth About Life After Eating Disorders, just published by Warner Books. Now, what about, there's certainly a lot of food obsessions in our society now, mania about toxins and mm-hmm. Fats and mm-hmm. meats. And, you know, so we've got hyper-vegans and just all kinds of food obsessions. Is that at all related to anorexia, do you think?
Absolutely. In fact, that's part of the half-life of eating disorders. A great many, if not most, and I was one of them, people who graduate from the official eating disorder then go on to all these other kinds of restrictive eating patterns. There's a term for the quote-unquote healthy eaters, which is orthorexia, where you become fixated. You can only have raw food, or you can only have organic food, or you can only have food that's been, I don't know, you know, raised in purified water or something like that.
So what is the way out of this? I mean, first of all, what is the method of treatment now that has any kind of effect?
It's very – I have to say that there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is that there's a lot of new science. What I put into Gaining was all the science that's been coming up in the last – really, the last 7 years, since the year 2000, there's a lot of genetic research, a lot of biochemical research. They're looking for medications that can help reduce the anxiety, so that will give people a base of calm to kind of rework the way their mind functions. The bad news is that science is with eating disorders about where medicine was with tuberculosis back in the 1900s, in 1900. So we have a long way to go. There are different treatments depending on whether you're a child still living at home. There's one kind of treatment for those folks. That's the Maudsley method has the best results. For people who are very bulimic, multi-impulsive, meaning that they binge and purge in lots of different ways and maybe cut themselves and maybe alcoholic as well. There's a therapy called dialectic behavior therapy that has shown good results. For more middle-of-the-road bulimics, cognitive behavioral therapy has shown good results. It really depends on the individual case. There's no one-size-fits-all treatment any more than there's any one-size-fits-all reason why people become eating disordered.
But as you said earlier, the masters of our healthcare system, the insurance companies don't like to pay for this sort of therapy.
They do not. They used to. The irony among the women that I interviewed for Gaining was that those who were severely ill back in the 70s and early 80s survived survived because in those days, the insurance companies listened to what the doctors ordered. So if the doctor said a young woman had to be in the hospital for 3 months and she came out and she immediately started losing weight again, the doctor could then say, well, I think you better go back in the hospital now. I interviewed women who were in and out of the hospital for 20 years before finally getting better. Today, that would never happen because many, I shouldn't say all, but many of the insurance companies refuse to acknowledge that these are biochemically based mental illnesses, and they put them into their little square that says they only qualify for 1 to 4 months of hospitalization. After that, you're on your own. So what we have today are very, very, very sick people being kicked out of the hospitals that are trying to at least maintain their weight, and they're being thrown out, and they are dying.
Now, we certainly hear a lot about obesity, and God knows that's highly prevalent in American society. But what is the prevalence of anorexia?
Prevalence of anorexia is about 1 to 3%, and bulimia of women. And bulimia is upwards of 3%. But in raw numbers, what the experts estimate is that there's at least 10 million Americans who struggle with the symptoms of eating disorders, even if they don't.
Is that at any given time or cumulatively over
the
years?
That's at any given time.
So
yeah.
Cumulatively over the years, a lot of
it's,
many, many,
it's
many.
It's a lot. I mean, my guess is probably it's more like 30 million adults struggle with symptoms or, you know, have lingering symptoms. And, of course, then you get into what I call this half-life of eating disorders when people consider themselves recovered and the medical establishment considers them recovered, but they have all of these the kind of legacy of eating disorder, which is very compulsive behavior, very anxiety-ridden lives, fear-based lives rather than lives that are lived out of a passion and desire and drive to make a difference in the world. There's a line that I use in the book that came to me at the end after I was talking to a lot of people who had become activists after becoming recovered. And it's basically that we have to unlock ourselves in order to release our power to change the world. And I think that really is true. And you see it in the people who are truly recovered. They are so full of life and they are so full of change and they are so motivated to make a difference in the world, which is exactly the opposite of what you see when people are in the grip of the active eating disorder and even in the grip of this aftermath that I call the half-life.
We're just about out of time. You're making an appearance tonight. Could you tell the audience the details?
I am. I will be at the Borders in Columbus Circle at 7 o'clock tonight. And I have to say, the book's only been out this week, and I have been getting the most amazing mail from people whose lives are changed by reading the book, and lots of mothers and daughters are coming to my events and to these books, which does my heart so much good because it means that these people are tired of taking the blame for these disorders and they're hungry for something that explains why eating disorders occur and maybe the path to release from it.
And you also have a website associated with the book?
I do, www.aimeelu.net. And for people who are looking for more active help and resources from the medical establishment, I suggest that they go to www.aedweb.org. That's the website for the Academy for Eating Disorders.
All right. Well, thank you, Amy Lou. And I got to say, the book is a very nice mix of the personal and the analytical. You balance those two very well. And good luck with it, and good luck tonight at Borders, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, Doug.
I've been speaking with Amy Lou, who is the author of Gaining the Truth About Life After Eating Disorders and author of a book, almost 30 years ago now, called Solitaire.
That's right, 1979.
All right, well, thank you, and we will take a station break, and we'll be back to speak with Sam Gindin about a very different set of topics.
This is Piers Ficini in New York City.
We're here. We're back. We're on the block. The Barrio Block with Ibrahim Gonzalez,
Nando Alberici,
and Mickey Melendez. Music and issues of the Latino community. Politics, social commentaries, and cultural events.
On the Barrio Block every Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m.
All happening on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Streaming audio on WBAI.org.
And we're back here on Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood. This is WBAI 99.5 in your FM dial. And don't forget the website, WBAI.org. And let's take another little musical break, and we'll be back to speak with Sam Gindin. And that, an excerpt from Schubert's Piano Sonata number 17, performed by Alfred Brendel. And now we're joined on the line by Sam Gindin, who is an economist based up in Toronto, was a longtime advisor to the president of the Canadian Auto Workers Union, now is semi-retired to the academic life. Welcome to WBAI, Sam.
Hi, Doug.
So you are not among those very prominent school, not only on the left, but prominent on the left. You're not a declinist. You don't think that the U.S. Is sinking in any meaningful economic or political sense, right?
Right.
So let me let me just recite some of the usual items of indictment and see what your response is. You know, on the political side, the U.S. is suffering rebellion in Latin America as there's a broadening consensus against neoliberalism. The U.S. is totally tied down in a disastrous war in Iraq. The U.S. Prestige is at certainly its lowest since the Vietnam War and maybe ever since it's been an imperial power. And it looks like, you know, maybe we're Great Britain of 100 years ago. What do you say to that?
Well, I guess the first thing I just want to distinguish between whether there are problems, whether there's unevenness, whether there's various forms of resistance in certain areas, versus whether the system is on the verge of collapse. So when you look at Latin America, I mean, one of the points is that, first of all, quite generally in Europe, the United States, in Asia, obviously in Eastern Europe now and in China, India, the U.S. has got all kinds of areas for making profits very comfortable. If anything, capitalism is being extended, deepened, growing. Within Latin America, critical to all of Latin America is what's happening in Brazil. That's the key to Latin America. And in Latin America, it seems quite clear now that Brazil is being integrated through Lula into global capitalism. And in fact, Lula is doing things that a right-wing government probably couldn't do because it wouldn't have the base for it and would lead to more resistance. So what's happening in Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, these are very important. It's very important that neoliberalism is being challenged. But, this remains a question about how far this can go without other changes in that continent, because it's very difficult to make these kinds of revolutions in third world, you know, whether this will just be marginal on the margins of capitalism or whether this will, in fact, lead to something much more significant that can inspire others. And that's an open question. But at this point in time, those are things that America can live with.
And from Washington's point of view, Mexico still remains pretty secure.
Yes, Mexico.
Which is probably the most important piece of the puzzle for their point of view.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of conflicts emerging in Mexico that are going to be very important to watch, but Mexico remains secure. And as far as Iraq is concerned, again, there's an opening, and I keep stressing that in arguing against American decline, I'm also emphasizing that there are openings, but I'm trying to emphasize openings because these are the question is whether we can take political advantage of them. American imperialism is being discredited. When all is said and done in Iraq, after this whole process, America will have more bases internationally and especially in that part of the world than it's ever had, including extending into that part of Asia. A lot of the debate is about not about whether America should play a particular role in the world, but how it should play it. The criticisms from Europe are parallel a lot of the criticisms within the United States, which is a criticism of how Bush has handled this thing. And the question, therefore, is, well, how will the Democrats handle this? Well, they just handled it in a more sophisticated way, so we have a kinder face of imperialism and empire, or will something dramatic happen? And nothing dramatic is on the verge of happening. No one's, for example, saying, wow, there's a terrific thing happening in Bolivia and Venezuela in terms of poor people finally getting a chance to have a life. Why don't we go and support them?
Yeah, my pet theory is that Hillary Clinton will be the agent of recuperation of American power, but we'll see what happens in a few years.
I think you're absolutely right. Now in saying that, I think that even in trying to have a kinder face, they're going to have troubles with it. It is very difficult to run this kind of a complex empire. I mean, you're talking about making capitalism global. And doing it through other states, and this deals with all the problems that happen within each state. So it's a very complicated thing, as capitalism was complicated when they're trying, you know, when it was first emerging. So it's a very complicated thing, and even somebody like Hillary, I think you're absolutely right. This will be part of regenerating a new vision of America that is not fundamentally different, but it'll have its own problems.
But for a few years, it might work. Then let's turn to the economic side of the ledger, where we also have a familiar bill of indictment. We have a huge trade deficit, current account deficit of, close to 7% of GDP. Mm-hmm. Net foreign debt's now approaching 30% of GDP. We've got a loss of competitiveness in so many industries. Our auto sector, which is an area you worked in for many years, is barely got one nostril above water. We're losing an edge in high tech to Chinese and Indians, there's not much that we can export that people would want. We import just about everything that's on our store shelves, we borrow constantly to make up the difference. We've experienced a mad housing boom here that has finally burst, we don't know what the effects of that are going to be, but this could be the big one, a lot of excitable types say. What's your response to that line?
Well, this is very important because it's also related to what you can get away with on the political and military side as well. A couple of things. I mean, one of the things is whether capitalism is good for people or whether it's good for capital. And when you start measuring these things in terms of capital, profits are at the highest. Corporations are getting the highest share of profits they've had since 1929. Maybe
in the U.S. or worldwide? Are you talking?
U.S. corporations' share of profits in American GDP.
Yeah.
Is at the highest level they've had. So American corporations, in terms of their strength within the U.S., in terms of making profits, is very high. Their exports are growing very fast. I'll get back to the question of the import side of this in a second. The U.S. economy is amazingly dynamic. I mean, part of these losses, when you look at manufacturing, for example, over any period of time, it's not that manufacturing is disappearing, it's that manufacturing jobs are disappearing. When you look at real output, the U.S. is still producing an enormous amount of goods. When you look at it qualitatively, certain sectors are disappearing. Other sectors are in various kinds of problems, which also have to be looked at. I'll maybe say something about auto in a second. But when you look at the high-tech sectors, the Americans are still very much leading in terms of the high-tech sectors. They're in manufacturing, in biotechnology, in telecommunications, and even where third-world countries are doing more high-tech, it's high-tech that's linked to control in the U.S. It's work that's being outsourced. It's the lower-tech part of the high-tech industries that is being outsourced as American companies move upstream within those sectors. And a lot of this is also moving into services and the incredible American advantages in the service sector, which are even higher in terms of financing, accounting, law, investment services. In fact, the way a lot of countries and companies try to catch up with the United States is increasing their dependence on those very institutions in the United States that helped the United States earlier grow. So at all those levels, the U.S. is very strong. Now, the question of its import deficit...
The model you describe sounds pretty good for elite workers, but for the working class, they've got nothing, not much
absolutely.
But retail and janitorial work to look at, right?
Right. Which I completely agree with. And I think what we really have to be careful in this distinction is that when we ask this question of is America in decline or not, what are we talking about? Are we talking about what's happening to working people, or are we talking about the strength of the American economy and Goldman Sachs, et cetera? So I'm arguing that the American economy is strong. It's not strong enough to be able to say to workers, we can give you everything you always wanted and still make profit. But it's strong enough to keep making profit and to get away with everything that it's doing to workers in order to do this. And part of my argument is that as long as there isn't resistance, as long as you don't bring the question of resistance into this, if every time there's a problem for American capital, it can solve this by squeezing workers harder or by shifting jobs around any way they want, they'll fix their problem. They'll fix it at the expense of workers. So the fact that America is so strong doesn't translate in any way into what happens to workers. And it's until people start saying, look, there's a barrier to what you can do. There's a barrier in terms of what you can do around health care. There's a barrier to what you can do in terms of the environment. There's a barrier to what you can do in terms of restructuring in your interest. There's a barrier to what you can do in every workplace. There's a barrier to how you can treat people who work at McDonald's or treat immigrant workers. Until those things become barriers, they're going to restructure and do fine, and there isn't going to be a decline. So that's the challenge to us. And even in the auto example, the auto industry in the United States is doing well. It's just that General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler aren't doing as well. General Motors is doing, it's still the largest auto company in the world.
I thought Toyota was about to surpass it, isn't it?
It's catching up very quickly if you project their growth rate. But it still is, and even if General Motors and Ford were the second and third largest, these are large companies. General Motors couldn't be profitable at 25%. It'll get down to 17 or 18% of the market. But the other point of this is that other countries, other companies feel that they have to be inside the empire. They have to be inside the United States to remain strong and to be profitable. So they come here. So they are producing jobs here. They're producing wealth here. They're producing taxes here that can also support a military. So you've got this restructuring that goes on with enormously negative effects on people. But the American economy, and especially to think about this in terms of the American empire, it's powerful. Let me give an example comparing it to 1945, because you look at 1945 and you say, geez, in 1945, U.S. was everything, had half of the industrial production in the world, and today it's in the low 20s and sinking. But if you look at it another way, what you see is that today they can get the savings of the whole world and use them. In 1945, there are no other savings to get. Today, they have sites of accumulation and making profit in China, over a billion people in China and in India, and increasingly in Eastern Europe. Well, they didn't have that in 1945. In 1945, they had to confront the left that was limiting them in the United States, very, very worried about socialism and communism in Europe, and national liberation movements everywhere, all over Africa. These things aren't there. Now, what the imports mean right now is the U.S. is sitting there, and it can say all this labor that's going to producing goods in the rest of the world, we can have access to. We can have access to all of this cheaply, and since 1980, we've been running a deficit, and that's fine. Nobody else can do this except the American empire. So it's a measure of their strength, not their weakness.
All right. I should say I'm speaking with Sam Gindin, who was a longtime economic advisor to the Canadian Auto Workers Union and now teaches the political economy department at York University in Toronto. Well, let's the debt issue is important. We have to import a lot of what we buy, and we borrow the money for the Chinese Central Bank, essentially. Which gets the money from foreign investment coming from the U.S. and from the things we import from them. So they're recycling what we send them in the form of loans to us. Now, Is that really a sign of strength, or is that a sign of potential vulnerability?
Can I go back a step, Doug?
Sure.
Just when you mentioned the debt, I mean, there's the fiscal debt as well, which people used to be very worried about. But what you find out with...
Well, the fiscal debt is pretty moderate. I don't think that's very...
It's moderate, and it also shows that when the debt is about lower taxes or financing the empire, big business will accept it. It doesn't become an issue. When it's actually about showing that there's a lack of discipline because it's actually being used to give workers health care or whatever, then it becomes a problem. And I think it's going to become a problem down the road because of the health care costs that will emerge. But it will become a problem because people will see it as if you actually dealt with it and gave people the health care that they need, it would be money going to people. And we should be showing a lack of discipline. And then all of a sudden there would be all the concerns about making sure that it actually goes to what it to what's good for profits, and then if people don't resist, they will solve that problem. Okay, the larger deficit. Yes, this is, you know, we're used to thinking in terms of national accounts, and now we have to think in terms of, okay, there's a global economy, and there's especially an empire, and does this mean that we have to think about this differently? And I guess what I'm arguing is that for most countries, national accounts still matter. People do look at what is happening with your trade deficit, and that affects your currency and what you can get away with. For the Americans, what we've seen for 25 years, because what the Volcker shock was about was very much showing the world, this is a time of inflation in the United States, that we will limit inflation in the United States, we will be disciplined, we will restructure. The United States will be the one place in the world that you can really have confidence in. And that's been the basis for getting this investment. You know, investment comes into the United States not just because there's a trade imbalance. A lot of this is coming in because people find it an attractive place to be, either in terms of long-term security or wanting to hold the dollar in case they have their own crisis, or because just direct investment is profitable. So the point is that the world, there's a structural relationship between the United States and the rest of the world in which the rest of the world accepts this as part of what it means to have global capitalism, that in a sense the United States does act as the consumer of last resort and keeps the global economy and has kept the global economy going through some critical times. So there are going to be problems of adjustment. Certain kinds of adjustments will take place, and they may be a little bit uneven, but they're not adjustments about somebody deciding all of a sudden that, well, we don't need the United States as a leader. We can be the leader. No one else can take on that role. And if China were to do something like to say, we're not going to hold the U.S. dollar anymore, we're going to put it into euros or into yen, the first thing that the Japanese and the Europeans would do is to buy dollars with it, because they don't want their currency going into the stratosphere. They don't want to play the kind of role that the United States played. So there's a structural dependence that everybody has on the relationships as they exist now. Now, that doesn't mean that can't be changed. I do think, for example, there'll be much more diversification in what people are holding. But the kind of change it would mean something like Asia deciding that instead of sending all this money to the United States, let's have a different model of development and pass this money around in Asia to help Asia develop. Well, that implies a lot of changes in terms of relationships to capital. It means China has to be quite different in terms of its interest in attracting European and American investment. You know, it means moving towards a different kind of planning and planned economy. So again, it comes back to, unless there aren't major social changes in social balance of forces within these countries, there's no reason to expect this thing to fall apart. It's going to reproduce itself.
Yeah, let's talk a moment about the politics of this, because it seems to me that a lot of people look to political or economic crisis or some combination of the two as a kind of cure-all for their own political impotence, that if they're unable to organize, well, the system is going to fall apart, and then suddenly it's going to collapse into our waiting arms in which we can fix it. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, the first thing is that I don't think we can win if we can't show that capitalism, even when it's working well, sucks for people. In other words, without a crisis, we have to be able to show that, you know, whatever capitalism achieved in the past, it's become a barrier to human development. I mean that both in terms of ecology and in terms of, you know, development of human potential. So we have to be able to show that capitalism, even when it works well, is the problem. Because otherwise what you end up with is you have a crisis, and then people say, geez, I wish we could go back to the way it was before the crisis, in the good old days when capitalism was working normally rather than moving ahead. I think that's one thing. And the other thing is that this means a radical change in values. And I think you put this really well on a platform I was on with you once when somebody was talking about stimulating the economy more, and you asked, if capitalism's so bad, why do you want more of it? And, it, you know, you were saying it half-jokingly, but there's a question amongst, you know, that we have to ask ourselves about our own values in terms of what kind of a society we want. And this, you know, you auto workers have to confront this when you're talking about the environment. But the main political point is, you know, the one that you're getting at, which is that it is people's impotence, and I see this especially when I talk to Americans, of feeling so helpless that they think that it'll be solved if there's a crisis. And this is wrong, first of all, because even if there is a crisis, it doesn't mean that all people will want is to go back to the way it was before the crisis, and maybe they'll make some concessions to do it, which has happened. You know, it's like auto workers saying, well, maybe if we just make some concessions, General Motors or Chrysler or Ford will be okay again, and our life will go back to normal. Whereas, in fact, all that does is it's a diversion from what the real problems are. You know, like the auto companies getting away with the last 15 years. They are very innovative, and they decided to move into trucks. And they shifted all their production virtually into trucks, so they're making 75-80% of their production as trucks. And they get the energy crisis. So that's one problem. The other problem is if you really have a major crisis, and it's deep enough and they can't get out of it, you could have fascism as well as any, you know, as much as you could have something else, where people just look to a strong leader to solve the problems and give them the basics again. So the point is we have to organize. And I'm also convinced that if we don't organize and aren't a barrier to them, I don't think a crisis will happen. We'll have some downturns, we'll have some problems, but they'll keep solving the problem at our expense. So the crucial question, and it's the most difficult one because there's been such a defeat, and it isn't just an American problem, is how do we start building some kind of a left that actually challenges the legitimacy of the system? And what strikes me, and you know, a lot of people have been talking about this, is that there really are openings. You opened this with your own comments about the loss of credibility, the loss of legitimacy. They've had neoliberalism for so long. They've had everything they wanted in terms of let us break the back of inflation and everything will be fine. Let us privatize and everything will be fine. Let us have all these corporate tax breaks that will be fine. Well, it's you know, now they're vulnerable to people saying, wait a second, you've gotten everything you want. You haven't delivered the goods. Maybe you're the problem. And to start raising questions about the power that capital has. Well, one of the problems you have in the labor movement right now is that every time you discuss what the problems are, they talk about how much power the corporations have and what they're doing with that power. Then when you ask, well, what's the solution, they end up calling for solutions that make the corporations stronger, like subsidies to the corporations.
Oh, we've only got about a minute left, which doesn't give you much time to answer this question. But
okay.
A lot of the kind of intellectual and organizational leadership should be coming from the American Union movement, and it doesn't seem to be. Do you see any bright signs on the organized labor landscape here?
No, I have to say quite honestly that I don't. I think that there's been a major defeat, and until something can actually start bubbling up from below, not much will happen. That doesn't mean that there aren't, you know, there isn't a good labor leader here or there isn't a good labor leader there. But there has to be a notion that what has to be taken on are the class issues. So when labor talks about organizing, it's not just about getting some new members or protecting what it used to have, but it's actually about how do we build the working class. And unless we don't ask that with every issue, whether it's health care or corporate rights or free trade, so that, you know, opposition to free trade isn't just some you know, a very parochial thing either. Unless we put everything in the perspective of class, we're just not going to get anywhere. And we're still going to depend on the labor movement. But right now, the labor movement is not going to lead this. Somehow, it's going to that kind of leadership is going to have to emerge in a different. I mean, the labor leadership isn't going to lead this. It's going to have to emerge from other kinds of movements and from workers below. And then we're going to have to figure out how to get the union movement as a whole on sign.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us with
great, Doug. Good
not
to
the
talk
most
to.
Cheering message, but thank you for your honesty, Sam Gindin. Okay. Speaking with Sam Gindin, who was a longtime advisor to the Canadian Auto Workers Union and is now teaching in the Political Economy Department at York University. And his piece on Monthly Review's website, you can go to mrzine.org, mrzine.org, and search for Sam Gindin, G-I-N-D-I-N, and look for Is the Big Ship America Sinking? That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. And let's go out with a little more Franz Schubert, this piano sonata number 20, Alfred Brendel.